Welcome to Vital Interest. My name is Karen Greenberg, and I am the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Our podcast is designed to help you understand security in its many dimensions. Each week, we will bring you thoughtful voices from the worlds of policy, government, law, journalism, and advocacy. We will look at the challenges that confront us today and tomorrow, from pandemic to climate change, from terrorism to population migration, from war to peace, all with an eye towards the rule of law, the protection of human rights, and the respect for civil liberties. Vital Interest Podcast is committed to making the world we live in more comprehensible, the part we play in it more engaged, and our futures more secure. It is our way here at CNS of connecting with our times and with one another.
What I'm really saying is that without what I'll call truth, without some obligation on our part to try to get to an answer that our critical thinking skills bring us to, I don't think we have much of a foundation. We end up instead with everybody just saying, well, you know, I believe this, and so that's good enough. Well, no, you know, if we're gonna work together, let's think about how we're gonna base our decisions based on some level of evidence and some logic so we can reach a common understanding.
That was Richard Kahn. He is the managing partner of Innovate Partners, an emerging company private investment firm. He is also the head of Eurasia Advisors, and he founded the Moscow office of the law firm of Latham & Watkins in 1992. Richard Kahn is an avid chess player, and he is actively involved in First Move, a not-for-profit organization introducing chess into the curriculum of U.S. public schools. Richard Kahn is the author, and this is why we're here today, of The Earthbound Parent, How and Why to Raise Your Little Angels Without Religion, which was published in 2018. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you, Karen.
The book starts with a provocative title, The Earthbound Parent. So let's just start there. I'm very involved in thinking about language. So tell us what The Earthbound Parent is.
Well, the Earthbound Parent, in terms of the title itself, is designed to emphasize the idea of it just being us on this planet together. I'll be talking about the idea that you don't have to include a deity of any sort in your parenting skills. And it also is a way of referring to grounding oneself, being more humble in one's view of our place in society, not having heirs that were related to some supernatural entity. It tries to capture both of those concepts.
Who did you write this book for? When I was reading the book, I wasn't necessarily thinking it was only for parents, but sort of metaphorically for those who are taking care of our lives and of our world.
You're correct, Karen. I do mean it more metaphorically. It certainly is for a far broader audience. The philosophy, the approaches I talk about in there really are a social commentary discussing an ethical framework that's applicable to parents, children, grandparents, but not necessarily the parenting relationship. Although there is also sort of an undercurrent in terms of how I'm presenting it, that all of us should look at our place, you know, on this planet as one of having a responsibility to care not just for our environment, but for one another. And so there is an aspect here of referring to ourselves as parents and having that obligation. But as you probably are also aware, in terms of trying to, over time, alter the role that religion plays in our society, it did strike me years ago that the best way to accomplish that would be by having parents consider how they're going to raise their children in terms of passing along or not passing along religious mythologies. And so I felt that from a practical perspective, that would actually provide some mechanism for change rather than mere identification of what I view as sort of a problem in the underpinnings of our ethical framework in society.
Yeah, and that's what I want to dig into a little bit in this first part of our conversation, which is what are the problems that you see as tying your parental skills or your worldview to a religious sensibility?
Yeah, I'll start with a true story that I told on a few occasions. My daughter asked me when she was falling asleep one night, what happens when she dies. She said she was scared. She was about 5 years old and she was having trouble sleeping. And at that moment, I could have given her a what I'll call a supernatural answer. I could have said, don't worry, sweetie, under the magic blanket, you're fine. You know, the pillow is special quality, or there's somebody with a beard up there who's going to watch over you. Instead, I said 10 words to her, and she went right to sleep, and she never brought up the subject again. She's now 11 years old. The same thing happened with my older child. The 10 words I said were, it will be just the way it was before you were born. And it turns out David Hume used a similar construction several centuries ago. In other words, one of the problems I would identify in our society is the use of fantasy or wishful thinking, delusional thinking, in terms of creating that as the foundation for society. If, as many people would agree with me, it's not an accurate representation of reality and it's not actually based in truth, but is rather just an artifice that people utilize, feeling that that's somehow a helpful structure to have deity, you know, a deity or several deities as a source of authority in a society, that that's useful. I think it undercuts the integrity of the society itself because it's not based on anything real. Second, I think that having a supernaturally based sort of society or ethical system, it allows people, one, not to think about ethical issues, because if they're a member of a group that is somehow tied with a supernatural, you know, a belief system, there's an automatic assumption that they're stamped as good people. So they don't have to consider ethical issues. Moreover, they're in a position of being able to look at those in other groups unempathetically, because they're not part of the saved group or the ones who are tied to the true religion. So, and it also creates obvious divisiveness in society. I don't spend a huge amount of time on that. Writers like Chris Hitchens, you know, spent more time on that. But there's no question that if you have a mindset that you're sort of on a team and that team is in conflict with others, that does create conflict. A lot of what I'm writing about in the book is to say there's really nothing to fight about. And there's no reason to continue having this structure in place where we create this supernatural narrative that divides us. So those are some of the problems.
And would you tie that more broadly to other forms of teams like the nation state? You know, your identification, your political affiliation. I mean, I get that part of what you're saying is that it takes on a grandiosity and a power because of attaching a spiritual presence to it or a divine presence to it. Is it also the case that's really at the heart of this is this divisiveness that's encouraged by separating into groups, into tribes, into enclaves, into countries?
There are, I think, significant differences, and you hit it one, which is obviously one, that the power of the authority that one feels comes from a supernatural link is far greater. And so that, I think, leads to greater divisiveness. But more importantly, it's what I'll call the irrationality or the delusional nature of that or the fantastic nature of that, that I find, frankly, the frightening aspect of religious authoritarianism versus what a nationalistic one. There is no question there are actual physical boundaries between countries at this stage of our development. That's reality. And there are physical needs groups have for water or for power plants. And there is a history that brought us to this point. Am I a huge fan of the divisiveness of nationalism? No, but that's part of, you know, our history. It's difficult to ignore that that's real. And you can negotiate based on those basics, right? The supernatural element is entirely different. And in fact, this is one of the two or three reasons why I started the book when I was much younger. You can't resolve a conflict if the person says to you, you know, that rock that you were fighting about was given to me by my God. And the other guy says, well, no, that was given to me by my God. And their names are different. One is Bill, one's Jim. But There is no way using these supernatural constructs to find common ground. If you're talking about terrestrial matters and you're negotiating over those things, you can trade, right? Whether it's on water rights or energy, whatever, and you can deal with things. So you're correct, Karen, that likewise, I'm not a fan of people being overly nationalistic, but at least that's reality. That's something we can negotiate. And there are ways of dealing with that in the real world.
What about the part of this that addresses or doesn't address spirituality? So there are a number of people who would distinguish between formal religion and spirituality, and would argue that spirituality is something that some tie to a divine being, some do not, but that they feel very strongly that it makes them not more, you know, sacrosanct people in the world, but more centered, less likely to act out, just more, you know, one step back from what's going on to take a look at it. Would you distinguish between spirituality and religiosity or not?
Yeah, first, let me say in the book, as you know, I distinguish between religious culture and belief in a supernatural entity of some sort. Right. And I do think the latter is what I will say leads to problems and what I would discourage parents from utilizing and raising their kids and as part of their ethical framework. The culture of religion is quite different. What people eat, you know, the music, these again are part of reality. I liken it more to nationalism to tie to our last conversation. Mm-hmm. Spirituality, first of all, I would say when someone says to me that they're spiritual, what I really interpret that normally as meaning is I'm a good person. I'm an ethical person. And that's sort of shorthand for that, meaning that it's, that they, you know, that they're concerned with their fellow man, they're concerned with larger issues than themselves. And obviously I applaud that. But to the extent someone wants, Karen, to sort of say I'm spiritual in the sense that I believe in something more than myself, generally speaking, like as with most religions, they keep that very vague. They're not saying there's a piece of pasta floating around Andromeda that I think is the source of all goodness in the universe. It's the vagueness of it that allows both religious organizations as well as people you're describing who say that they're spiritual to sort of get away with it, because the lack of specificity just lets you say, yeah, there's something more than me. So the bottom line is if one defines that as just meaning I'm ethical and I think about other people, I love it. I sort of go on the spectrum, though, if it's really delusional thinking and there is some level of belief that, you know, someone is directing them, that they're in contact with some being, and it justifies activities for which they're not going to take responsibility, then I put it more in the category of the organized religions. But obviously, the organized religions are more of concern to me because of the power they wield and because people who are part of that feel part of a group and can act together in that manner, which is to me, you know, what I refer to as religious authoritarianism, and which I think is really quite dangerous.
One of the things that you say that is that, and I'm quoting, basic morality is natural to human beings, which is a very interesting idea. So it's sort of like you're reality based, and the reality is that, you know, morality is, you know, basic, built into human beings. What makes you think this?
I give a few examples, and I will come at it from the angle you're bringing it, which is sort of going way back in time. How do we get here? I view it as really just a part of natural selection. In other words, just as there may have at some point been crocodiles, animals, smaller life forms that ate their young, which we would view as sort of immoral. Well, that line of development died off rather rapidly. And similarly, over time, we self-selected not just for height and beauty. If you go back 200,000 years to the beginning of apparently of Homo sapiens, according to Jared Diamond anyway, and Guns, Germs, and Steel, which seems like about the right time frame, there's no difference in self-selection for those qualities versus character. Just as people today look at one another and think, oh, who's going to make a good father or a good mother? They take into account character. And that is what I'm referring to. I think self-selection is a perfectly good explanation for why we end up, generally speaking, not universally, but with what I would call more and more morality and ethics in our societies over time. We have had self-selection just as people have become taller through the generations.
You know, it's interesting because you focus this on the parental organization, the family organization. And there's a couple of things I'd like to talk about that refract against that. One is that one of the things you talk about parents is not just what they're conveying, but how they convey it. That you make the argument for parents, you know, putting their heads together, mindfully coming up with a plan, you know, intentionally setting out what they're trying to achieve. In setting that out, do you have this impression that parents don't do that, that they just sort of take it as they come and react day, you know, in day without any kind of, in a general way, any kind of thoughtfulness? Is there a critique embedded in that or not?
It's not a critique as much as a recognition that not everyone would approach it that way. I hope people do, but I don't really have a database to say how many people sort of are going through their lives and parenting in desperation, just running from their job to sleeping to trying to feed the kids, turning on the TV for, you know, to try to act as a babysitter. And so I do think of it as aspirational, in a sense, for people to recognize we have a choice as parents in what we do and how we do it. You don't have to do what everybody else does if you don't wish to.
And do you think that there are institutions that we need to have created that can help with this?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. I would love to see parenting taught at some level in school. I think that would be a wonderful addition, maybe to the health courses that are taught in high school or some courses in college. That's just an area that we at least in my experience, don't touch on at all. But I can't think of a subject that's more important than how we raise our kids. Again, it would not be a course that advocates exactly what I'm suggesting, but might have some of the ideas that I and others have that are different than those that that might be more in the mainstream.
One of the things you do in the book, and you've done it in this conversation, is sort of refer back to others who over the centuries have thought about this issue in its largest sense, right? You mentioned Hume before, you mentioned Kant and others in the book. When you see yourself sort of the intellectual, you know, predecessors to the kinds of things you're trying to talk about, who are the main philosophers, thinkers that you're kind of building your argument on?
You know, I'll be candid. I don't think of it that way at all. Just as I'm not a fan of ancient texts that are just viewed as correct because they're old and used by religions for that purpose. Likewise, I would want to be cautious in citing a brand name intellectual from the past and suggesting that means that everybody should listen to what I'm saying. I think it should be based on reasoning with people, on logic. Do I draw from some ideas? Yes, but I don't think that just because Kant or, you know, 10 or 15 other people, Freud and others that I've written about in the book, have ideas that are similar or pieces that make sense to me, that that's a reason why people should, without thought, just follow along. But certainly I'm not out there as the only person who's ever talked about some of these ideas. That's true.
No, and you're talking about them in a different context, in a different kind of focus, which is on the parent, which is actually, you know, sort of a new tack on it. But one of the things that you do talk about is the emphasis that there needs to be in bringing up your children on critical thinking and how to think about the world they're in. It's not just some abstract morality that you're talking about. It's also a sense of critical thinking. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you see these two things, morality, ethical sensibility, and critical thinking, and how they're related to each other in your frame.
Sure. You know, first, in terms of critical thinking, I want to explain to folks that to me, the opposite of critical thinking is what I will call faith-based adoption of ideas. So I'm not suggesting that someone who believes in a deity cannot engage in critical thinking as well, but I'm saying in that specific realm, you know, there our place in the universe, our relations with one another, there I would call it a suspension of critical thinking to say, well, I'm not going to think about that. I'm just going to rely on faith. And I would note that ties in my mind to sort of the training one can receive in the wrong direction, which is to embrace the idea that I don't need evidence for faith. Likewise, I don't need evidence from any other authority figure who's giving me sort of information. That to me leads down the slippery slope towards conspiracy theories in a society that is not based on critical thinking. So right there, there is, I'm sure you can see, sort of an ethical element. What I'm really saying is that without what I'll call truth, without some obligation on our part to try to get to an answer that our critical thinking skills bring us to, I don't think we have much of a foundation. We end up instead with everybody just saying, well, you know, I believe this, and so that's good enough. Well, no. You know, if we're going to work together, let's think about how we're going to base our decisions based on some level of evidence and some logic so we can reach a common understanding.
So that's interesting, because faith is also something that brings comfort. And we live in a world where the fears seem to proliferate, right? Whether it's pandemic or global economic downturns, or, you know, displaced persons due to violence and climate change. There's so many things to be fearful of. And faith, in a parallel way to what you're talking about, is also a place people find comfort when they can't deal with the pain, suffering, anxiety they're going through. So is there some way that faith can also be a good thing? Is there a way to cabin that off from what you're talking about, or not?
Well, first, let me say, I mean, you're getting into what I will call the cost-benefit analysis of religion, right?
Okay.
And which is different than whether it's real or not, right? That's a whole different thing.
100%.
I'm saying that the religious aspects are not necessary. I'm not saying that you can't utilize them. If you want to go through the cost-benefit analysis I put in the book and come out that you think there is a benefit to it, even if it's not necessarily real, fine, you can do that. But I think I point out that there are so many benefits on the other side that you can glean from this, and so many costs to our society as well as to our children of being raised with what I will call this supernatural delusion, that I don't think it's a close call. But I would agree with you, Karen, that you can find elements of religion that are helpful. For example, you know, you talk about hope. You know, my way of looking at the world doesn't offer immortality, right? That's something that some people may want, and they want to believe that. Whether it's true or not is, of course, a whole different thing. I think a lot of positives come from the idea that our time here is limited, and we ought to work together to solve problems and help our children and our grandchildren and generations coming down the road be in a better position than we are. To me, that's what ethics are founded on.
Yeah, and that ties directly to your interest in conflict resolution, right? And I'm assuming this sort of evolved over time. You wrote this book over several decades. And I'm curious to know at what point the, you know, conflict resolution became, you know, a focus for you, and how you see it in the general scheme of the larger theme of the book.
To me, it's a natural outgrowth of thinking through what is it that divides people, and what things are able to be adjusted by negotiation and which are not. But I can't say, Karen, that I, for example, went over to Russia to work with Yeltsin's team in order to resolve conflict. At some level, yes, and you know, anything that brings our societies closer together, our trade, our cultures, reduces conflict in my mind. And also learning languages does that. But to me, it's all on a spectrum rather than sitting in a room and trying to necessarily negotiate a particular issue. That comes up sometimes too. But I see conflict resolution as a broader cultural process. And the book is really designed in part to move it in that direction.
Where are we in the process? Are we like at the very beginning of what you're talking about in terms of development of critical thinking and a rejection of thoughts about the supernatural? Are we evolving in the right direction, or are we in stasis? Where are we as a globe?
Boy, that's a tough one. I've seen articles that say that the world is becoming more religious, not necessarily in the West, but certainly in parts of Asia and in the East, I guess you would say, and certainly in the Middle East. I don't think we're very far along. You know, I'll start by saying, you know, as a chess player who gets to see computers play chess, I don't share the arrogance of our species that we're all so brilliant. I don't see us that way. I think it's It's hard for us to think clearly. It's hard for us to be dispassionate and rational. It's hard for us to be empathetic towards one another. I don't see us as doing all that well in this, and particularly given the types of weaponry we have and the types of divisiveness there is in the world. I do worry that we're not able to control ourselves particularly well at this stage, and that we're not moving away fast enough from delusional states of mind that would allow us to take actions that are not rational for reasons that that would only be explained by people's perspective that they're tied to some deity who's giving them instructions or going to reward them in the afterlife.
You talk a lot about this, embrace of the rational, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that you also referred to is the rule of law, right? You went to law school. I'm curious, where in this process of your own personal development, the deciding to be a lawyer came? Is this to you a step in the right direction because of the emphasis on rational thinking? Is it because of the ability to use law to make the world a safer place, a more ethical place? How did that fit into kind of your evolution?
Yeah, it began when I was quite young. I think I knew I wanted to learn law and become a lawyer, from sort of as early as I can remember. I guess I saw Perry Mason a few times, although I didn't go into criminal law. But I think from a very early age, I sensed that this was sort of the foundation or a foundation of civilization. And I felt that it was sort of our best chance to get along. And I wanted to be part of that process. I'm sure in some ways it also related to my own sense of how one creates order and safety in a world that, as you were pointing out right now, is fraught with peril. I think ultimately having rules we can agree upon and procedures that we're going to follow when we can't agree, that's really the only way away from violence. And so just as I saw and still do see rule of law as a critical element in civilization, likewise, I see moving away from sort of these mythologies that divide us. I see that as a step in the same direction, if we can do that.
I'm just wondering how much of this is something you think could be addressed by more strategic psychological work in the schools and elsewhere, not just in parenting. You're part rationalist, part, legal mind, but also part psychologist, right? And so the question is, what do you see the role of psychology? And if you see it as big a role as I think you do, how does that make you think maybe this could actually take a particularly long time?
First of all, to explain to the reader, I do spend time in the book going into why I think people are drawn to religion. Because unlike, and I won't simplify this too much, someone like Richard Dawkins, who I think has an undercurrent of feeling that people who are believers in a deity are stupid. I don't see it that way at all. I think, I know plenty of super intelligent people who believe in a deity. And so the question in my mind always was, well, what's going on there? What am I missing? What are they seeing, thinking, whatever? And so what I do explain in the book, what I think are the psychological reasons that link all of us together, including me, in terms of wanting to believe certain things to deal with certain fears and desires that are common to all of us. And what I'm saying in the book is it's understandable, therefore, why you go in the direction of a deity, but there is an alternative that will also address those concerns. And the story I told about my daughter earlier is an example of sort of how you can deal in other ways with fears and desires. But in answer to your specific question, Karen, I don't hold my breath for our psychiatric sort of colleagues to step forward and help in this effort. I have found actually that the psychiatric world, at least in the US, is really part of the power structure, if you want to think of that way, that would not challenge the status quo. Also, keep in mind that since especially in the US, our society has a tremendous number of people who subscribe to the delusion, or at least talk about it and feel they need to signal that they, are ethical by being part of a religious group. It's extremely risky for people to say otherwise, and particularly professionally risky. You have to have lived in Russia and faced a lot of other risks to be willing to talk about it. I'm sort of teasing, but it's not a well-worn path.
You know, in terms of the responses to this idea, are there parents who have come to you and said, thank you for helping me think through this? Are there political scientists who have come to you and said, I agree or I disagree? Are there policy folks? Who do you think this is resonating with so far the most?
It's resonating in different circles. When I give talks on the topic, I get a tremendous amount of positive feedback. Often people feel that it's a relief to have it said, and they will share with me that they've done the same types of things and how they approach parenting. So I would say that most of the commentary is coming from parents, but a huge amount just comes from everyday people who understand this is going to the heart of sort of their everyday philosophy of how they're living and how they relate to other people. And so I get a lot of positive feedback that way. I would say there's very little negative, but that's probably because, Karen, you know, folks who have a different viewpoint may not be willing to even read the book, you know, and think about it. Even though we in the world that are not fans of deities and belief and such, we're exposed constantly, both in youth and later, to the theories that support, you know, a deist view of the world. And, you know, and again, it explains why I wrote the book this way, to appeal to parents who are or and to people who are along the spectrum of being willing to consider it. And I wrote the arguments in the book in a manner to persuade those, realizing that I probably would never get a shot at a hearing before those who are so set in their ways that they would never listen to any countervailing points.
Given what you've said, there are a couple of things. First, we are in the United States, which is different than being in some of the even, you know, extremely troubled, fragile societies of the world. And so that's one thing. Two, there is a way in which what underlies your book is we're kind of in trouble. Whatever, you know, the reason is, as humans on this earth, we're in a situation that's in trouble, even if we're in a safer space rather than an unsafe space. How do you think about this in terms of hope? Do you think of it in terms very much tied to our particular time and place? Or do you think of it as something that actually has a more expansive application? And first you'd have to define how you actually see that hope given the world we live in.
Yeah, let me first say that I don't think the way that I look at our place in the universe leads to nihilism or lack of hope, anything like that. I think quite the contrary. Just as I, as a parent, do everything I can every day to make the world better for my kids and try to be constructive in that without expecting a deity to help me or anything like that, I do the same thing in my life in terms of how I interact with the world. And I think when you realize that it's just us, if you adopt that framework, there is a tremendous power that comes from that. One of teamwork and obviously wanting to coordinate with your friends and others, a humility that comes from that and realizing, gosh, we've really got to solve these problems together. It's going to be hard. We don't waste time talking about supernatural things or hoping that someone else or some power is going to solve things for us. So to me, it's an adult approach to the world. And just as we as parents are accountable and take responsibility, I think there's tremendous power and positivity that comes from recognizing that this is our chance during the few years we have to be constructive on the planet. And I encourage everyone to do that. And not just spend their time patting themselves on the back about being part of some blessed group. Let's get to work and do some good things together.
So to sum up, it's on us and we have to do it together.
Yes.
Thank you, Richard Kahn, for joining me on Vital Interest Podcast.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you for listening to today's conversation. We hope it made your day a little brighter, a little clearer, and a little more informed. Join us next time for the newest installment of Vital Interest Podcast, In the meantime, feel free to send us your questions at vitalinterestpodcast.org and to follow us on Twitter at @VI_podcastCNS. And make sure to check out our daily morning brief, our weekly cyber brief, and our Vital Interests online forum at CenterOnNationalSecurity.org. Have a wonderful week, and please stay safe.